Today I'm sitting in front of the fire with Gloria Steinem. Thanks a lot for welcoming us in.
It's wonderful to have you here and be out of the cold and having a great conversation.
Let's start out by saying that we're going to talk about the new book that you're bringing out just now, and it's called My Life on the Road. And it's a lot about some of the traveling that you've done over the years. And I always used to think and worry about how you would have so many trips that you would do, and you just would come back from one and have another one that was calling you. And now, after reading the book, I'm feeling much more comfortable about it and how you came to view traveling as a part of life, really.
I think it's a form, this may say odd, but it's a form of meditation in a way, you know, because it forces you to live in the present. It forces you to be open to accident, to people you don't know, to spontaneous events. And since we can only live in the present, as it happens, it's a good thing. I have overdone it in my life when I really didn't have a proper home. So I've learned over time, and this book is really the story of learning, that we need both home and the road, you know, that even birds need nests. So I've come to see that we need both, but we still live in a culture that views them as opposites. Either you settle down or you're on the road, when in fact I do think we need both.
Mm-hmm. I really liked it when you came to balance at the end of the book and talked about sort of reaching that point where you realized that there was a value in having it and that you sort of needed to develop a place for you to call your own.
Mm-hmm. Yes, especially for me, because I had grown up feeling homeless and feeling somewhat sorry for myself, but also kind of proud and stubborn in that state of mind, because my father was something of a gypsy. He had a summer resort in Michigan, but as soon as it got cold, he would put us in a house trailer, us being me, my sister, my mother, and the dog, and make our way to warmer weather in Florida or California by buying and selling antiques and jewelry and so on along the way. I mean, you know, we never started out with enough money to get where we were going, but somehow, miraculously, we were able to. And that childhood, plus a fair amount of moving once they were divorced and I was living with my mother, made me into somebody who used to wander around New York looking into lighted windows saying, everybody has a home but me, you know, feeling sorry for myself. But I still, the message that we, as especially as women, only make homes for other people, that is, when we have kids, we're married, for our husbands, for our partners, somehow the idea of making a permanent home for a single woman was something I didn't grow up with. Mm. So though it's much more common now, it took me a while to get to that idea of balance of both home and the road.
I was thinking about when you talked about traveling with your father, because my father loved to travel also, and they were building the interstate at that point, and they call them turnpikes, and he used to always want to get on the turnpike to find out how far they'd gone. You know, every year, every summer, he'd want to see what they'd done to get to how close to Florida we could get. So I think part of what your father was doing may have been part of the culture at the time after the war, and with the car as becoming a different sort of mode of transportation.
No, I think you're right, because both of my parents would have remembered a time when cars were very rare. Mm-hmm. So the romance of the car, you know, and being able to travel independently was still very big. And Detroit was pushing this romance,
yes,
sometimes in very unethical ways, you know, buying up railroads and destroying them, mm-hmm, along the California coast, or buying up streetcars and destroying them, so people would have to buy cars. But it was definitely post-World War II era of becoming a car culture.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The other thing that I really chuckled at was you're talking about sitting in the back of the car and reading, and your mother saying, look at the scenery, because we had the same thing that we took a trip out when I was in seventh grade. We drove to California, and we went to the Grand Canyon, and we went all those places, and all the two little girls sat in the back reading their books, and my father kept saying, look out the window.
Exactly. And I would say, what? I looked an hour ago, you know, as if it was the same. I suppose it was our way of making a home in our heads, in a way, you know, reading books we loved and authors we loved. Although I did have a permanent romance with any pony ride that we came across. And I have to say, for my father, he always stopped. But, you know, the only other person, or perhaps in addition to you, who grew up this way is Judy Collins, because her father, who had a famous radio show in Seattle, was blind and was driven by his wife, her mother, to various venues. Oh. So she would be in the back of the car. And she also talks very movingly about being at home in the dark of a kind of backseat and moving vehicle. And I still do feel that. But also, there's something else here, which is that communal transportation, as great as it is not described. It has an added virtue, which is it lets you talk to people and get to know people, mm-hmm. which, you know, you're, especially if you're the driver and you're alone, you're isolated in this tin can of a car. So in writing this book about being on the road, I had to remember to explain that I didn't drive. You know, it seemed so natural to me that I didn't drive. I thought, no, I have to explain. People will think it's quite odd.
That's right.
Although I have to say that Jack Kerouac did not drive either.
Oh. I want to bring in, so we don't leave it out, the communal women's cars that you describe. And this is not cars now. This is railroad trains that you described in India, because that was fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and being a student in India and living there for a couple of years, of course, looking for cheap ways and safe ways to travel, my sister's students at Miranda House in New Delhi told me that I should travel in third-class women-only railway cars. So I did that all the way down the east coast of India, which is quite a long trip. And it was an education in itself. You're in a mobile dormitory, and people are very open and questioning and curious, which must have driven the British totally crazy, I think. So you learn about each other. You know, I learned all kinds of ways to tie a sari, including if you were playing tennis, how to tie a sari, and about all kinds of food. And they were asking me why I wasn't married, you know, why my parents hadn't found me a husband, and did everybody in America carry a gun, which, of course, a question now has become even more relevant than it was then. But it was a very profound 3 days of intimate learning.
You ascribe a big part of your life, or it was an important part of your life, that you decided to go to India instead of staying in America and sort of doing what everyone else does after they graduate from college.
Well, I did, well, there were two things. One, I was engaged, and I knew that I shouldn't get married. A very nice man, but, you know, it would have been a mistake for both of us. And also, when I went to look for a job, it was just, I mean, I wasn't conscious. There was no such thing as feminism or a woman's movement in my life, but I would go to advertising agencies and they would explain that I could do research there, or that, of course, women couldn't deal with clients because, you know, no client would want to deal with a woman. And I went to Time magazine and they also explained that women did research, but they didn't write. That was the system. So even though I wasn't conscious, I realized that this was not a bright prospect.
And so what did you find in India?
At first, everything, of course, is a revelation. And it was only about a dozen years after independence. So it evoked the kind of hope and idealism that South Africa would later also evoke. But first it was just intense learning, and then after a while I sort of lost the ability to write fellowship reports every month, which I was supposed to do, because it didn't seem odd. It seemed natural. You know, I don't know, I felt oddly at home. Somebody from Bengal told me that I had been a Bengali in a previous incarnation and that I had done something very bad in order to get born in the United States.
Oh, gee. That was your retribution?
Yes, right, right. But I did sometimes feel that way, you know, because there's such diversity there and such, out of diversity, a high degree of acceptance. Not that there aren't huge problems of caste and class, there are, but still there's a kind of live and let live atmosphere that felt different from home and felt like home.
Oh, that's nice. It's nice when you can go to different places like that and make a place for yourself and feel comfortable. That's a great skill to have.
Also, there were other foreign students, several from Africa. And even though I had never been to their countries in Africa and they had never been to the States, when we got homesick, we would all go to a Chinese restaurant together. We discovered that Chinese restaurants are universal in the world. Mm-hmm. You can be there and pretend you're anywhere. So there were not just many different kinds of parts of life in India, but also of people who were there from other countries. And I had never lived outside of the United States except for a junior year in Geneva, which was not that profoundly different. Mm-hmm. So it was really helpful to me to learn that most of the world did not live the same the way that we do here, on the one hand, and on the other hand, that people are people wherever we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Part of your not driving is that you've had drivers various places in cabs or people who've picked you up for various events that you had to do, and you always seem to have had conversations with them and have gotten little tidbits from them. Mm-hmm. So that has kind of given you a different point of view.
Well, my argument for traveling without driving is that you are not isolated in a tin can by yourself. You are in a train or a taxi or a bus or an airplane, and this happens the moment you leave your door. If I get into a taxi or a bus or whatever it is, I'm with other people, and you observe them, you get into conversation. So, you know, I really think it's an advantage not to drive, because the trip does begin when you leave your door. And it does continue through all the forms of transportation. I don't always talk to the driver or to somebody. But even when I don't start it myself, something often happens that causes somebody else to start it. I mean, I got in a taxi, this is long after finishing the book, in New York, and we passed a sign, a big advertisement for one of the vampire movies, the many vampire movies or series on television. Mm-hmm. And I just said randomly to the driver, you know, I think I understand a lot of things, but I do not understand the appeal of vampire movies. Where did that come from? He turned out to be from Transylvania. He told me that there had been, in centuries past, a much hated, very rich family who lived on a nearby mountain or something, and that all this mythology had grown up around them because they were hated and they were cruel to the people who worked for them. And so this mythology of blood had given. And now, what are the chances that in New York I'm going to get into a taxi with a guy from Transylvania? I probably wouldn't have put that in the book. Probably nobody would have believed it, but it happened.
I know. I have to tell you that there are other things that you did put in the book that I can't believe. I can't believe that you sometimes would meet people that you had met 30 years ahead or before.
Yes, especially because I have been in Manhattan for such a long time. As big as it is, you do sometimes get the same driver. It has once or twice happened to me, even in the same day, that I've gotten the same driver twice. But over time, it's really interesting because then it's like reading a novel. You get, they tell you the rest of their lives.
I can't believe it. Well, let me tell you a story that I'm sure you don't remember, but when you came to New Mexico for the Women's Political Caucus in 1980 or so, I think it was 1980 when we had the national convention there, One of the caucus members' sons was the driver who took you to the airport or picked you up from the airport. And afterwards, he reported that you told him that if he must read porno magazines, he should at least steal them and not pay money for them.
I don't remember that.
Well, it was kind of legendary around there.
Well, it was a concession because I'm sure I was hoping he wouldn't read them at all.
Yes.
Since pornography is, I mean, it's present in the words, you know, porne means female slavery, and it's not the same as erotica, which means eros, love, mutual pleasure, and so on. And so I'm sure I was trying to say that to him, but I guess I was bargaining.
Well, your words were certainly noted. I also wanted to remind you of that time, because one of the things that you talk about is the feminist movement in your book, that it comes in the early feminist movement, and that was when there was some tension between women of color, especially, and white women, and we had the what people were saying then was the feminist movement was only white women and they didn't care about women of color. And there was that wonderful moment when you were on the stage in Albuquerque and Eleanor Holmes Norton came up to the stage and you bent over and there was this hug that showed up in a picture on the front page. Mm-hmm. So that was a wonderful moment for us in New Mexico.
Well, I'm glad. It's, you know, it does still worry me that even in academia and in histories, it is still looked at as if the women's movement was invented by white middle-class women, when in fact it was disproportionately invented by black women. And the very first Lou Harris national poll on women's views of feminist issues in the women's movement, the results were that over 60% of black women supported the issues and the women's movement and so on, and only 30% of white women. Mm. It, you know, it was always disproportionate. And I fear that the way it was covered by the press was partly just everyday racism, you know, that they are way less likely to cover things in the black community. Right. And also an unconscious or conscious effort to divide.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. Yes. And I remember at MIS that Dorothy Pittman Hughes was very involved with starting the caucus and at that point she was starting a daycare, mm-hmm. and working really hard on that and certainly not trying to be exclusive or anything. Mm-hmm.
No, actually, it was the kids in Dorothy's daycare center that painted our desks. Remember, we got our desks free from because they had been thrown away by the old Herald Tribune. The kids came and painted them bright yellow and red and green and so on.
Well, the other thing that I remember from those days, and I'm not sure if you remember, is that when you were doing all the traveling, whatever trip that you were going on, you would always call back to the office immediately, mm-hmm. not only when you got someplace, but when you were in transit and you stopped off at it, you know, you were changing planes, between planes, you'd always call. And towards the end of the book, you talked about your traveling and also your feeling in touch with a place that was home base.
Yes, the magazine, Ms. Magazine, and all of the great cluster of women in the office gave me a home base in a real professional sense, even long before I had a home. And it gave me a place to bring home information or ideas for stories that I'd encountered on the road. And I think I did it so much that various people would make fun of me coming home with little scraps of paper in my pockets and distributing them to people and so on. But it was certainly important to me, and I think it was helpful to the magazine, to have a kind of scout out there identifying stories, seeing new events, seeing trends, seeing needs. Because of that, we had a classified section for a while, for instance, and that helped women start their own businesses because people would get more response to their business in Ms. than in McCall's or some much bigger magazine. Oh, you know, it helped not just cover the news, but in a way create news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk about what it was like to go to campuses, especially with Margaret Sloan and Flo Kennedy.
Generally speaking, there was a kind of pattern, because we would have been invited by activists who were already there and doing great work, and they would meet us at the bus station or the plane, the airport or whatever, and they would say, you know, well, we've hired this hall for tonight, but we're worried that not enough people are going to come. And then we would ask them about the issues on campus so we could use those as an illustration of, you know, what things that needed to change. And then, we'd get to the hall and it would be filled and overflowing. And because there, even though the general media didn't acknowledge it, there was a huge amount of interest in this explosion of consciousness. And then we'd end up having to have closed circuit television or fill some other room or walk across campus to another hall. And that, you know, we wouldn't have been there without those hardy, pioneering organizers who invited us. And they wouldn't have known the general appeal to the general population of social justice movements if we hadn't helped them send a larger signal. So it was always interesting, and especially interesting as we would go back to the same campus after 5 years or 10 years. So you could see change. It was like reading a novel. Women's centers had sprung up. Campaigns to have more lights on campus so it was safer, or to have a process to report sexual assault, or to have, and in the beginning, to have women's studies and black studies and gay and lesbian studies, which were not part of the curriculum and are still not part of the core curriculum as they should be.
Mm-hmm. And Flo Kennedy and Margaret Sloan were certainly characters.
Yes, this got started in my life first with Dorothy Pittman Hughes, not because I said to myself, a white woman and a black woman should go lecture together, though, of course, that is a good place to start. It was because I was afraid to do it by myself, because I'd never spoken in public. I devoted a lot of energy to never speaking in public. And Dorothy Pittman Hughes was absolutely fearless. Also, she had children of her own, and I did not, and she was indeed an expert in early childhood education, and clearly I was not. So we each extended the experience of the other. Mm-hmm. And it was great traveling together, you know, just for us as individuals, and for making kinds of audiences feel invited who would not have felt invited by either one of us separately.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about your developing your speech style. There is a book, apparently, of your speeches, and there, and yeah, yes. A professor contacted me one time and told me, and he was using it for his class, on speech writing and making speeches. And he talked to me about your technique, which was just, I think, developed out of necessity.
Yes, I should ask him what my technique is. Because I was very fearful of public speaking, I always made sure that, I mean, I didn't speak that long, and that allowed time for the audience to have a discussion that was at least as long as the speech. And I think that was helpful because it created a balance, a kind of two-way street, and made us more as if we were sitting in a circle talking to each other, and not so much like one person lecturing to others while they look at each other's backs, because that hierarchical structure, while it's necessary in big groups, is a repeat of patriarchy, and you know, which starts hierarchy. So I think that together we evolve, Flo and I, or you know, Margaret and I and others, a more circular kind of lecture. And we would always say to them, you know, you don't have to ask questions. You can give us answers. We could use some answers. Or you can make organizing announcements or tell us what's happening on campus. Mm-hmm. So that it got out of the false idea that there's authority on stage and not in the audience.
Mm-hmm. Talk about organizing. Or I guess it's organizing sort of led into campaigning, or maybe it was campaigning that came first. But you talk about Bella's campaign being when you sort of mainlined campaigning as it got into your blood.
Yeah, I'd been campaigning a little bit for a long time, you know, beginning with Adlai Stevenson. That's a seriously long time ago. And, you know, contributing my efforts to some Senate campaign or presidential campaign at a very low level, you know, but just trying to help. But it was really only Bella's campaign that made me understand that you didn't have to join a campaign per se, that social justice movements actually have more credibility than political groups in many ways. People trust social justice movements, and that we could campaign and acquire influence with the candidate themselves in terms of what issues they supported by being able to deliver votes ourselves. So both things were true, you know, both influencing the campaigns and campaigning for that particular candidate. And I've continued to do that, and I think it's very satisfying because if you join a campaign, even as a volunteer, you can only say what the campaign says. Mm-hmm. But if you're outside of it, talking to different constituencies, you are free to pressure on the issues, including to pressure the candidates, and also to generate votes. So that's what I've done ever since.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's talk about Hillary's campaign, because you really explain a lot about what your thinking was in her first campaign for president, and how that kind of evolved. And I think it's really an important explanation to have.
Mm-hmm. When she was first running for president, I, in my heart, did not think it was possible for her to win, because we just hadn't seen enough women in public authority to make it okay. And since we're all mostly raised by women, we tend to associate female authority with childhood. And some especially grown-up men who crave authority are upset to see a woman in authority, because it makes them feel regressed to childhood, which was the last time they saw a woman in authority. Yeah. So I didn't think it was the time that Hillary could win. And of course, she and Obama were pretty exactly the same on the issues. I did support her because she had much more experience. And I thought, well, we can have 8 years of her and then 8 years of Obama. I hope it's the other way around. I hope we have now 8 years of Obama and 8 years of Hillary. Because I do think she could win this time. I think we've seen enough women in authority, so we're a little more, at least some people are a little more comfortable with it. But it's going to be a very tough campaign, very tough.
Do you think? You think that even though most people are thinking that she'll get the Democratic nomination, that it'll still be tough?
It'll be hell, absolutely hell, because the Republican Party is in control or is controlled by people who are in no way traditional Republicans. Mm-hmm. They're extremist on economic and religious issues. A lot of them used to be Democrats before the Democratic Party got too inclusive in terms of race and economic theory and so on. So not because it's polarized 50-50 among Americans on the issues. We in general, and Hillary probably has 60% of everybody in public opinion polls on issues. But because, say, 20%, the extremist 20% is in control of one of the two parties, it makes it look 50-50. Mm. And press coverage gets to be 50-50. Yeah. Certainly the ultra-right wing has demonstrated how much they hated President Clinton and also Hillary Clinton, and they have a lot of money. So it's going to be hell. It's going to be very difficult.
You had some good things to say for Democrats who would say, I would support Hillary, but I don't trust her, or whatever.
Mm. Yeah, I don't quite understand. You know, we'd have to ask the individual person why they're saying that. But it's my impression that it's based on the not on her, but on her husband's administration. Mm. So I think she might get a button that says, I wasn't born a Clinton. I guess maybe we could wear those buttons. Maybe she couldn't. So maybe we should get buttons saying she wasn't born a Clinton. Not that Bill Clinton was not a constructive president. He was. Mm-hmm. But he did do things that, you know, like undermining the welfare system and the trade agreements. You know, I mean, there are problems there that she should not be held responsible for. Right. It was not her administration.
Yeah.
Right.
And this whole thing about holding her responsible for his going after women is just something I can't understand at all.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes no sense. I think also what I would just say about that is that if you see them together, you know, I've only seen them maybe three or four times, but in groups of very interesting people in the White House or this last time when Bill Clinton got the Peace Prize and, you know, they're in groups of amazing, wonderful people, and they are as interested in talking to each other and listening to each other as to those other people. Now, I don't know too many longtime married couples of whom they really respect and like each other. And I think that for women especially who perhaps have only a sexual relationship with their spouse, and if they are replaced sexually, even briefly, they feel they have no other connection. Mm-hmm. It's different, you know. But it seems to me the Clintons are really partners, different people who respect each other.
Mm-hmm. What are you planning to do in this campaign?
I imagine that I will do what I've done in the past, which is join with other activists and friends who have time to do this, rent a house in a swing state where voting is important, talk to local activists about where it would be helpful, you know, to have meetings and so on, and talk especially to independent and Republican women, because I fear that feminists, some feminists and some Democrats, say to Republican women as an accusation, how can you possibly be a Republican? Well, if they were probably born in a family of Republicans, and also the party used to be very different. Mm-hmm. So if you just, you know, that's not helpful to accuse people of it, right? So if you just say, look, the party, you didn't leave the party left you. Mm-hmm. So let's just talk about the issues and, you know, what's in the interest of the majority. Then you can have a conversation. And that's what I've done in the last couple of elections, and I think that's what I will do in this one.
Okay. Are you hopeful?
Yes, I am. I am hopeful, but I also acknowledge what the, how shall I say, you know, what the Koch brothers have done in terms of, I mean, and many others, not just the Koch brothers, and the unlimited spending on campaigns that has so perverted them. Also, the efforts of state legislatures that are controlled by the right wing in many states to redistrict in a way that advantages the Republican Party and to keep people from voting or make it difficult to vote around universities or in neighborhoods that are black neighborhoods. I mean, the whole question of identification and credentials, and we make it way more difficult to vote than any other democracy in the world. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to contend with that. Even in the last presidential election, when I was in Florida, in black neighborhoods, you could see people waiting in line 3 and 4 hours. Mm. It's just a disgrace, really a disgrace. Mm-hmm. So I guess, I mean, our message has to be not only vote, but fight to vote.
Yeah, I really loved when you talked about the founding of the Women's Political Caucus, since that's something that I was involved with for a long time. And you really talked about how exciting it was and how immediate it was. Mm.
Yes, it was the first national time since suffrage, really, that there had been an effort on the part of women altogether, in and out of political parties, to encourage women to vote, to support issues that were important to the majority of women, and to encourage diverse women to run for office. That was the purpose of the National Women's Political Caucus. And such an organization hadn't existed in this wave before. I mean, NOW was not yet that active in the electoral system. Mm-hmm. So it was really necessary. And the Democratic Convention in 1972 in Miami Beach was the first big focus of this effort. And quite scary, I have to say, because we had just had one big conference and put the idea out there, and people had come from states who had not even met each other in the states necessarily, much less met people from other states. And it was all coming together in a very chaotic and dramatic way. And there was a lot of attention on the part of the media. So, you know, it probably shortened all of our lives by about 10 years. But it did turn out to be worth it. Mm-hmm. It did.
Mm-hmm. But there were some really skilled political women who were involved also in the there were some who were just coming for the first time, but there were some who were really skilled.
Yes, because from Eleanor Roosevelt forward, and perhaps before Eleanor, there had been women who understood the importance of the political system and tried to get elected, infiltrate, influence issues, absolutely. Also, there had been women in progressive unions like the UAW, the United Auto Workers, Millie Jeffrey, Edie Van Horn, mm-hmm. these, you know, people who through the union movement understood the importance of these issues, and also as women who had been active trying to equalize things inside the union. So they were very helpful because mm-hmm. they were very skilled.
Yes, yes. And there were also Republican women who were, and I mean, that was an important thing for the caucus, mm-hmm. was to involve Republicans.
Yes, at the time, the Republican Party was not as not nearly as controlled by the ultra-right wing. So there were Republican women who saw to it that, for instance, the Republican Party supported the Equal Rights Amendment, which the Democratic Party did not. You know, it was way, way more centrist and in some ways progressive, sometimes more progressive on race, too, than the Democratic Party, which was too controlled by particular forces in the South.
And so the Republican Party was more progressive on race then?
Sometimes, yeah, it was. It was. I mean, for instance, Jesse Helms, who was a senator, a U.S. senator, and deeply, deeply opposed to this, to civil rights legislation, when the Democratic Party embraced civil rights legislation, left and joined the Republican Party and began to export the racism into the... I sometimes feel Democrats ought to apologize to the Republican, to real Republicans, for all these people who migrated and took over their party.
I've noticed that you have been, since the book has come out, and we should say that this is something that you've been working on for...
How many years?
Well, I've been working on it for 20 years, but what that means is I would do it for a month in the summer and then not do it for the other 11 months.
Well, as it has come out, you have been doing a lot of talking and sort of talking about the book, but talking in general, traveling back and forth even more than in the past, I think. So tell us a little bit about how it's been received and what you've been doing.
Yes, I've gotten educated by this process of adding to my usual travels, which means going to a conference or a campus or a particular event, these book events, which are just open to the general public and just announced in the newspaper or whatever, and that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to do it with other people, as usual, so I try to, for instance, in Chicago, Roxane Gay, who wrote Bad Feminist, who's a wonderful young author, African-American author, and wonderfully witty and fun. We did it together here in New York. I did it together with Ta-Nehisi Coates and Bryan Stevenson. And then sometimes it's by myself, too. But it's just a call to the general public. And that has been an education because it's taught me that there is an explosion of consciousness, part anger, part hope, thanks to an economic understanding that was dramatized by the Occupy movement, thanks to Black Lives Matter and all the recognition of racism in our structures of authority. Thanks to things like my high school in Toledo, which used to be a place where boys went to work in the factories afterwards and girls got married and so on. Now it's a center of sex trafficking and drugs. Mm. So for all kinds of reasons, the consciousness level is very high. And there was no place that I went that wasn't completely filled up within a day or two.
Yeah.
And that meant the kind of, I would say it was a minimum of 500 people and sometimes 2,500, space for 2,500.
Wow.
It was an education. Maybe it's because of the web, too, that people can get information now and out of a linear sense of time. Mm-hmm. So in a funny way, whether you're old or young, it sort of doesn't matter. You're all on the web, right?
That's good.
I don't know, but I was amazed and touched and educated.
Well, tell me about what's going to happen to some of the... We were just talking earlier about what's going to happen to some of the material that was cut from the book.
Mm-hmm. When I do the paperback, I believe I can add a chapter of some of what was cut. And then I can also begin to add some on the website. So these travelers' tales can continue.
That's good. At the end, I was really touched when I was reading about the death of Wilma Mankiller, which was a very moving thing for you. And you described it, so you really brought people into it, I think. And what touched me especially was that she knew what was happening and she was in charge. Mm-hmm.
It made me, that experience of being there for 2 weeks or so before Wilma died in her home in rural Oklahoma with her family members and friends and people coming to visit and, you know, just, it was the most communal, I mean, it made me understand community in a way for the first time. First of all, there was absolutely no pretense on anybody's part, including Wilma's, that this was not perhaps their last time to see Wilma. Mm-hmm. Secondly, people would just come and look around and see what needed doing and do it. Mowing the lawn, you know, bringing food, whatever it was. However, with that, you know, traditional Native American emphasis on both community and the individual, it's not either or, her daughters asked me to write down what each person had done so that person could be thanked later. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, it was a lesson in balance between community and individual. We too often think it has to be one or the other. Mm-hmm. And just sitting there and having conversations around the kitchen table and with all kinds of people who came. Orrin Lyons, for instance, who is the chief of the Iroquois Confederacy now, the League of Six Nations, its headquarters are in upstate New York, explained to me about lacrosse. You know, lacrosse is a Native American game traditionally that they invented and they still travel around the world playing. And we, of course, have just become conscious, although we should have been conscious 20 years ago, of the danger of football with all the brain concussions and injuries and mm-hmm. so on. So I was saying to him, how in such a cooperative culture can you play such a competitive game as lacrosse? Not as violent as football, but very competitive. He said, well, you don't understand. We play it differently. Mm. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, it's a game of skill, and each player is responsible for the welfare of the player opposite that person.
Oh, wow.
It's completely different, right?
Oh, how nice.
Anyway. So in every way, it was a communal learning experience. And people would speak about Wilma's death as going to the other side of the mountain, you know, to be with the elders. The idea of heaven, of course, is an invention of monotheism, which is kind of, the elaborate system of reward and punishment is, mm. you know, is much later invention. It was just a feeling of rightness, you know, and not so much rules as shared understandings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was a wonderful thing to sort of end the book with, and a wonderful experience, and made the reader, at least made me, want to have more. Mm-hmm. So are you working on more?
Well, Wilma and I had been planning to write a book, a specific book together. And actually, just before she died, we were supposed to spend a month, you know, working on it. So I don't know that I can do it by myself. I'm not sure. But I'm going to try to do it by myself.
Oh,
right.
Good. Great. Okay. Well, we'll be looking forward to that as the next.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.